Hello, welcome to the What Are Poems podcast, the only poetry podcast not steeped in pretension. I'm your host, Jake. How's things going out there in the world? Not good, right? It's hot. I'm hot. It's summer. Are these the dog days of summer yet? When are they? When are the dog days of summer? It feels like a dog day of summer today here in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. The sweat's coming out of my pores. One time, I was working at a pizza restaurant in Philadelphia, and this guy did a bunch of drugs, and he was sweating like an animal, and I was standing above the sink, and he just kept drinking Fanta soda after Fanta soda, Fanta orange, and he came up to me and said, Jake, how do I look? I said, I don't know, man, you don't look too good. He said, I'm sweating. I said, I think the soda's coming out of your face. Is that possible? Hey, the world's falling apart, right? This country's going to hell. What else is new? I was bartending the other day, and they had those white supremacists they caught in Idaho. And of course, someone, you know, because you're in a redneck country here, you're in the doomed days country up here. And this guy says, well, alleged white supremacist. We're caught in the U-Haul together. That's the thing about these guys, these white supremacists, these proud boys. They all get together, put on, what, Hawaiian shirts, and then cram themselves inside in the back of a U-Haul, shoulder to shoulder, nut to butt, sitting back there in the dark, waiting to what? Start shooting people? Start rising up in the back of a freaking U-Haul? I don't know. I'm very comfortable with my sexuality, but I don't want to sit that close to my buddy. You know? I say move over. Give me a little breathing room. Not these white supremacists. They say, I bet we could fit 10, 15 of us in the back of that U-Haul. My nut will be right next to your butt. We'll wear Hawaiian shirts and ammo across our chest. They all look like fucking Chewbacca on a Hawaiian vacation. You know, Chewbacca has the... When I was on the bus as a child, they would make me do two things. They'd say, sing Chicken and Cheddar, which was a song I wrote in second grade. Chicken and Cheddar, please pass the peas. Chicken and Cheddar, hurry up, I'm hungry. I got a cheesy feet. They'd make me do that. And they'd also make Chewbacca noise. Which is just, you know, and then they would, remember Blossom, the show Blossom? In your opinion, nation, the sun is very gonna shine. That was Dr. John did the theme song to Blossom. Well, Blossom was on, and Joey Lawrence used to do this thing where he would say, whoa. That was his catchphrase. In the 90s, it was a landscape of catchphrases. It was a land where you could go to school, go to the schoolyard, go to your office building, and you could just repeat one line, and it had taken the nation by storm. A Homer Simpson, don't, you know? Or in this case, a Steve Urkel, did I do that? And then Joey Lawrence's big Blossom line was, whoa. That's what he would do, and they loved it. So one time me and my mom were walking around the Kmart, R.I.P., Rest in Power, Big K, Rosie O'Donnell's sponsor, the Koosh Ball. Are we doing Stream of Consciousness stuff here? Is this Stream of Consciousness William Blake stuff that we're doing here? We were in Kmart, and this lady came up to me, and she said, oh, my God, it's Jake from the bus. And she said, can you do whoa? Can you do whoa? So I went, whoa, you know, as a little kid. And, God, did they love it. Joey Lawrence, who's going to be a sensation, tap danced. Let's not forget, did do blackface during his time with, what was the show? Give Me a Break. Give me a break from all your race. What's going on here today? Is it TV theme song day here on What Are Poems? Hey, hold on to your hats. Remember I said we were going to do Rupert Brooke? We're going to do Rupert Brooke. We're going to tell the whole story of the man, the myth, the legend, Rupert Brooke, Rupee Brooke, as I call him. It's a sad tale, and it's also rated PCMA, Podcast Mature. Remember in the days when Hulu wasn't Hulu yet, and it was just the Allstate guy saying, "You're watching Hulu." Well, anyway, that's it. This program is rated TV MA because Rupert Brooke, he fucks around. All right, stay tuned. We'll be back. So his name's Rupert Brooke. Remember we were talking about, say, I did say I was gonna, I didn't say I was gonna go away for a couple of weeks, but I had some things to do. The Edwardsville Pierogi Fest was happening, so I had to attend that. So I usually record on Saturdays. I couldn't get it done because I had to go eat like a bunch of pierogies. Those of you who are not familiar with pierogies, it's just cheese and potato wrapped in dough, and it's fried, or sometimes they boil it if you have Mrs. T's. Something you put butter and onions on it, and the pierogi fest is the kickoff of the fest season here in Wilkes-Barre. I guess really the fine arts fest is. Remember, I was gonna go, I didn't go, but it's pierogi, then kielbasa. It's just all food related fest. And Edwardsville is a small borough in Pennsylvania that's home to, I would say, like the majority of meth heads. If you took a poll, like 80% of the meth heads live in there. My friend actually has meth heads living next to her, and for a while she thought they were cooking meth because they had black tarps all around their house, and they weren't feeding their children, and she had to call in children and youth and secretly feed the children corn. But then the other day she's like, "Well, you know what? It just smells like maybe they're smoking it and not cooking it." So that gives you an idea of what Edwardsville is like. She's like, "You know, it's nice that they're not cooking it, 'cause I don't want my house to blow up, but they're just smoking meth." And then I guess they go outside, they sit by a picnic table and they look up at the sky. Their children jump on this trampoline. So it's horrifying, is what you're getting. But I was there, that's why I wasn't here, and now I'm back. But last time when we left, we were talking about John Gillespie McGee Jr., who wrote High Flight, and that fella was a hell of a fella, and this is the fella that came before him, Rupert. What if I got it wrong? Rupert Brooke. No, I'm right. So it's a quick life. It's a sad life again, but I thought we should do it so we know what's going on. Also, there was a poetry death today. We'll get into that in a minute. But there's a lot of things that happen with this guy that he's kind of at that burgeoning beginning. The World War I beginning, the first generation of poets. The guy doesn't even sleep with a woman until he's like in his 20s, but he is sleeping with all his buddies at a school. So, I mean, that gives you an idea of this fella. But let's get into it here. Rupert Brooke was an English poet known for his idealistic war sonnets written during the First World War, especially The Soldier. He was also known for his boyish good looks, and boy, is he known for this. They all love him for this. Yeats describes him as the handsomest young man in England. So what happens is there's two people in this world, as all stories go, that start the origin of one man. It begins with the marriage and love of another. So you got William Parker Willie Brooke. He's the third of four children. Rupert Brooke is the third of the four children of William Willie Brooke, a schoolmaster, and Ruth Mary Brooke, who is a school matron. So both his parents are working at this place called Fettes College in Edinburgh. And they meet there, and then William Parker Brooke, once they marry, he gets kicked out of the school where he's working because they don't have accommodations for married schoolmasters. So this is a world we obviously know nothing about. So it's like if this guy fell in love, got married, and then the head of this school said, "What are you kidding? You're married? No, you got to get out of here. We don't have accommodations for a married," which I guess what is it, like a full bed? They just only have twin beds or what? There's a small kitchenette? I don't know. There's no bread box. They should bring bread boxes back. I'd put my bread on a box, wouldn't you? We're not allowed those opportunities sometimes. Only the fanciest of the richest of the classiest, the martini drinking ladies have boxes for their bread. I just put it on the counter. Some people put it in their freezer. My dad freezes his bread. My parents, they just take, they love freezing the bread. Oh, I got a loaf in the freezer. They freeze, they buy one thing, they freeze another. When does that start? In your late 50s? You say, let me get two things and I'll freeze one. What's going on there? They also leave the butter on the counter. So they have to move because there's no accommodations for them because he's married. So they move to the rugby school a month later, and a couple of their children are born. And it's Richard England Dick Brooke, and then his sister Edith's born in 1885, and she dies the following year. And then his younger brother was William Alfred Podge Brooke. So he's right in the middle. He's the middle of three brothers due to a dead sister, in the tragic way that merry old England can be sometimes. So he attends preparatory school locally at Hillbrow, and then he goes to the rugby school. At the rugby school, he starts sleeping with his fellow pupils. So pretty much seventh grade on. I'm not sure what they call it in England, but seventh grade here. He's sleeping with Charles, he's sleeping with Denham, and he's sleeping with Michael Sadler, who ends up being this, like, guy who buys a bunch of art with his father and makes a nice living. And I guess would, at times, probably say, hey, you know, I slept with Rupert Brooke in seventh grade. But he has kind of a wild life, too. So it's odd. Sometimes, two men will sleep together in junior high and both go on to have life separate. At this time in 1905, though, Brooke also meets this guy, St. John Lucas, who's a kind of a weird novelist, and he becomes a mentor to him. In October of 1906, he went to King's College, Cambridge, to study classics. There he becomes a member of the Apostles, which is, so, like, from what I could tell and the research I've done, in England at this time, there's all these little groups that get together, and they're all like little groups of intellectuals, and they meet on Saturdays, and they have tea, and they talk about the important things in life, literature and politics and society. Kind of reminds me of in Les Miserables. I almost said Les Miserables, like the Abbé Sieyès Society. Where it's just young idealistic students trying to shape the world through their views. So the college years for all of us, you know, we just don't have these clubs anymore. I guess you just meet a guy, like a white guy with dreadlocks, who wears a drug rug and has a bong, and you go over his house on Saturday night, and you guys watch Jeopardy, or you watch Wheel of Fortune, and you talk about your ideas with these people. I once knew a guy named Egypt. He had a girlfriend, and Egypt was just a man as I described. And my favorite thing I ever saw was that Egypt was a large man, and his white dreadlocked body laid on this small sofa, and his girlfriend just climbed on top of him and laid on him as though he was like a mattress. And they were from the South, and he said, "This is how we do it." I thought, "My God, Egypt, nice to meet you." But so basically, Brooke gets to the university. He joins this Fabian Society, which is all socialist. Another member of this Fabian Society is this lady called Catherine Cox. He loves her. He's deeply in love with this lady. She's a neo-pagan. She's part of she's a friend of the Bloomsbury group, who I'll get into in a second. And she is a lover of Rupert Brooke. But she's in the Fabian Society as well. So at the school, Brooke forms the Marlowe Society. He plays in the Cambridge Greek play. The friendships he makes at school and university set the course for his adult life. And many of the people that he meets, George Mallory, the guy that climbed Mount Everest, fall under his spell. He's a very interesting fellow. Virginia Woolf, she goes skinny dipping with him. in a moonlight pool. And she tells people about it. She says, "Hey, guess who I just skinny dipped with? The handsomest man in London in a moonlit pool." In 1907, his brother Dick died of pneumonia at age 26, and Brooke planned to put his studies on hold to help the parents cope, but they say, go back to Cambridge. You keep skinny dipping with Virginia Woolf. You keep George Mallory under your spell. One day that man might climb Mount Everest. So there's a plaque at the orchard where he lived and wrote, and the words read thus: Rupert Brooke, poet and soldier, 1887 to 1915, lived and wrote at the orchard. So Brooke makes friends with these people called the Bloomsbury Group. The Bloomsbury Group is like basically like I was saying with the other apostles. It's just this group of writers, friends. They all hang out together, and they're all entangled in each other's lives, and they're all cheating and sleeping with each other, and it's like very much like what is that? I guess Dawson's Creek. It's like Dawson's Creek, Cambridge. It's Cambridge Creek. It's As the World Turns. But so that's going on. He's also an important member of the Dymock Poets, which is just poets that live in this village of Dymock. And he spends time there before World War One, and he becomes friends with Robert Frost and Edward Thomas. So he's just like a Forrest Gump type character when it comes to poets. He just knows everyone. He also lived in the old vicarage, Grantchester, which stimulated one of his best-known poems named after the house, written with homesickness while in Berlin in 1912. While traveling in Europe, he prepared a thesis entitled John Webster and the Elizabethan Drama, which earned him a fellowship at King's College, Cambridge. So then Brooke has his first heterosexual relationship with this lady Elizabeth van Rysselberg. She's a daughter of a painter, and they meet in Munich, and they have this affair. And they may have consummated, nobody knows, but it's possible the two became lovers in a complete sense in May of 1913. I like how this happens with poets a lot when we're reading about them and we're learning about them and we're living with them. The people that study these guys, they're like, you know what? Like John Keats, everyone's like, when do you think he had sex with that lady? Do you think he did or what happened there? And now these guys are saying, well, if Rupert Brooke did, it was in May of 1913 in Swanley. That's where he would have had sex with this lady. Like, could you imagine anyone being that interested in your life to figure that out? I can't. It was in Munich where he had met Elizabeth that year later that he finally succeeded in having intercourse with Cox. So Cox, Catherine Cox, the love of his life, main lover. He definitely succeeds with having sex with her in Munich, but we don't know. Maybe had sex, too, with Elizabeth in May of 1913. After this, though, Brooke suffers a severe emotional crisis in 1912 caused by sexual confusion. He was a bisexual, obviously. He slept with his seventh grade buddies. He slept with Cox. He didn't know what was going on. But jealousy resulting in the breakdown of his long relation with Cox. And his paranoia blames this other lady, who he believes he's Linton Strachey. I'm probably saying that wrong. But he believes that she schemed to destroy his relationship by encouraging her to see Henry Lamb. So this lady does this. And then he breaks and he doesn't talk to the Bloomsbury group of friends because he feels that they're part of his nervous collapse. Brooke tours the U.S. after this in Canada writing travel diaries for the Westminster Gazette. He took the long way home, sailing across the Pacific and staying some months in the South Seas. And this is where he meets another lover. It's a Tahitian woman named Tatamata. And they say that he seems to have enjoyed his most complete emotional relationship with this woman. And he may have fathered a daughter with her. But many more people were in love with him. Everybody loved him. He's involved with artist Phyllis Gardner and actress Kathleen Nesbitt, and was once engaged to Noelle Oliver, Olivier, maybe, whom he met when she was age 15. Yuck. Brooke enlisted at the outbreak of the war in August of 1914. This is World War I, and he came to public attention as a war poet, Early the following year, when the Times Literary Supplement published two sonnets, The Dead and The Soldier. So, let's hear those. Let's hear The Soldier and then The Dead, and then I'll tell you about his tragic end. Hey, folks, this is What Are Poems. Stay tuned. Okay, here is The Soldier by Rupert Brooks. It's going to be read by David Barnes. Okay, let's hear this.
If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by suns of home. And think, this heart, all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind, no less gives somewhere back the thoughts by England given, her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter learnt of friends, and gentleness in hearts at peace under an English heaven.
So I feel like it's kind of nationalistic, right, in a way? Are you feeling that? Are you getting that vibe? Well, I guess it's the war's on, but people respond to this poem. They love it. And he writes all these during the war. So this is what happens to old Brooksy when he gets to war. So he writes the sonnets, The Dead and the soldier we just heard. Brooks' most famous collection of poetry, containing all five sonnets, 1914 Other Poems, was first published in 1915, and a testament to his popularity ran for 11 further impressions that year, and by June 1918 had reached his 24th impression, a process undoubtedly fueled through posthumous interest. Brooks' accomplished poetry gained many enthusiasts and followers, and he was taken up by Edward Marsh, who brought him to the attention of Winston Churchill, then the first Lord. Brooke was commissioned into the Naval Volunteer Reserves as a temporary sub-lieutenant shortly after his 27th birthday and took part in the Royal Naval Division's Antwerp expedition in October of 1914. Now listen, Brooke sails with the British Mediterranean Expeditionary Forces on 28th February 1915, but develops a severe gastrointestinal issue while stationed in Egypt, followed by streptococcal sepsis from an infected mosquito bite. French surgeons carried out two operations to drain the abscesses, but he died at 4:46 on the 23rd of April, 1915, on the French hospital ship moored in a bay off the Greek island of, now I couldn't say it last time, Gyroskyros, in the Aegean Sea, while on his way to the landings at. As the expeditionary force had orders to depart immediately, Brooke was buried at 11 p.m. in an olive grove. The site was chosen by his close friend, William Dennis Brown, who wrote of Brooke's death, "I sat with Rupert. At 4 o'clock, he became weaker, and at 4:46, he died. With the sun shining all around his cabin, and the cool sea breeze blowing through the door, and the shaded windows. No one could have wished for a quieter or calmer end. That in that lovely bay, shielded by the mountains, and fragrant with sage and thyme." Another friend and war poet, Patrick Shaw Stewart, assisted at his hurried funeral. His grave remains there still, and a monument erected by another friend, Stanley Kasson, poet and archaeologist, who in 1921 published Rupert Brooke, a quiet essay illustrated with woodcuts by Phyllis Gardner. He's one of the first World War poets commemorated on a slate monument unveiled in Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey. The inscription on the stone was written by fellow war poet Wilfred Owen. It reads, "My subject is war and the pity of war. The poetry is in the pity." The wooden cross that marked his grave, which was painted and carved with his name, was removed with permanent memorial was made there. His mother, Mary Ruth Brooke, had the cross brought to Rugby to the family plot at Clifton Road Cemetery. Because of erosion, the open air was removed from the cemetery in 2008 and replaced by a more permanent marker. The cross is now at the Rugby School with the memorials of other old Rugbyans. Brooke's surviving brother fell in action on the Western Front in 1914. At the age of 24 years old, he had been in France on active service for 19 days before meeting his death. So the family loses the parents bury all their children. Terrible. In 1919, Lord Alfred Douglas writes, "Never before in the history of English literature has poetry sunk so low. In a nation which has produced Shakespeare and Marlowe and Chaucer and Milton and Shelley and Wordsworth and Byron and Keats and Tennyson and Blake, and seriously lash itself into the enthusiasm over the puerile crudites when they are nothing worse of a Rupert Brooke, if simply means that poetry is despised and dishonored and that sane criticism is dead and moribund." So some people don't like him, but some people are just rude, and I think Lord Alfred Douglas might be. Hey, let's hear the Dead. Not the Dead. I don't like the Grateful Dead. Have I ever mentioned that? They make me sick. Here's the Dead by Rupert Brooke. We'll end it with that, and then next week I'll be back. Oh, you know what? I do want to just next week I'll be back with another tale, another tale of another poet in our times. But here's the Dead by Rupert Brooke.
हेलो व्यूअर्स, तो आज के इस वीडियो में हम बात
आई
करेंगे
डोंट नो व्हाट दिस
कंसर्निंग
इज, आई डोंट नो व्हाट दैट वाज, सॉरी फोक्स, देयर वी गो.
These hearts were woven of human joys and cares, washed marvelously with sorrow, swift to mirth. The years had given them kindness. Dawn was theirs, and sunset, and the colors of the earth. These had seen movement and heard music, known slumber and waking, loved, gone proudly friended, felt the quick stir of wonder, sat alone, touched flowers and furs and cheeks. All this is ended. Waters blown by changing winds to laughter and lit by the rich skies all day. And after, frost with a gesture stays the waves that dance and wandering loveliness. He leaves a white unbroken glory, a gathered radiance, a width, a shining peace under the night.
I messed up there. I'm back. But you know what? In the end, I don't like sonnets. That's what it comes down to. I didn't like what that Lord Alfred Douglas guy said, but I don't like sonnets. You know what I like? I like the stuff that feels stuffy. You know? I don't know. That feels like there's a lot of stuff going on in it. That's what I like. Sonnets are so planned. I guess they have to be. Who the hell knows? Hey, until next, remember you can submit your own poems to the podcast at onearpoemspodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, my friends, peace and love, beef jerky.